This is FMR.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. Now, I wonder if you've seen the film or a production of A Streetcar Named Desire, Tennessee Williams's electrifying drama. Well, you'll have a chance now, because it's going to be performed right here in Cape Town at the Theatre on the Bay by LAMTA, the Loiting Alexander Musical Theatre Academy. And in the studio with me is the director, Chris Weir. And the show also stars as a guest Emily Child as Blanche Dudoit, and the production will open on the 14th of August. So, Emeritus Professor Christopher Weir has taught at Rhodes University at UCT, AFT in Cape Town, Rochester University in the USA, and NATFIS in Bulgaria, and he currently also teaches at LAMTA. He has been awarded the Fludo Cup Lifetime Achievement Award in 2012 for his remarkable contribution to the theatre industry. He founded the Intimate Theatre, affording a valuable platform for many young professional practitioners in South Africa, and he was a founder member of the professional companies, namely the Arena Theatre Company and the Mechanicals Collective, and his marathon stint, as they call it, has been in collaboration with Allen Committee, with whom he's done over 30 productions. We're going to discover all about that as we talk to you, Chris. Chris, we are welcome.
Thank you very much.
What a thing to be directing a play like this, where for a lot of people they will remember the film, won't they?
How do you tackle
something when there's been such an iconic film?
Well, I mean, I think one has to have an open mind. I mean, the film was made in a particular period, at a particular time, obviously launching particular stars. Mm. And if we make an analogy or a similarity, we're in that position of also launching a particular number of stars. Hopefully they will become stars. But our time and context has changed. So I don't have any problem with people who have seen the film and loved the film. But I would say if you're going to have a mindset, oh, I'd love to see A Streetcar Named Desire because I want to see another Marlon Brando, then I think that's going to limit your opportunities for enjoyment.
It's interesting.
Because it's a Stanley Kowalski. It's a character. It's mm-hmm. not Marlon Brando. It's not right. Vivian Lee, you know. And actors can bring their very distinctive stamp and important individuality to roles, as they should do. And hopefully this production allows those particular talents to breathe new life, fresh life, into those iconic characters.
It's interesting what you said, because it's, in a sense, a launch. LAMTA is a launching pad for so many now, as we've seen, young actors with their recent show, Spring Awakening, Hollywood. They're doing incredibly well. So you are working with young, exciting actors.
Yes.
Keen to make an impression.
Yes. I wonder if we could open this up as because I think it's an interesting debate. I haven't really had it face-to-face with anybody directly, but where I'm going is when I think of young professionals at 16, 17 in the tennis profession. You know,
yes, yes.
I say, well, you know, we can also have professionals coming in there. They can also learn their skills early or quickly or fast.
Especially if they're hugely talented.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially if they're hugely talented. But in my experience of looking at it, and as a teacher, it interests me to review certain things like or considerations, should I say, like in the days when there was a company like KPAB and the Performing Arts Councils, you had people contracted into a company for a substantial period of time. time, whether it was a year or 2 years or even longer. Mm. But what that afforded a lot of young people I'm talking about is the opportunity to come into a group of players and interface with very experienced players. So you had a very rich mix of players. And that experience is an important one. And I think we have gone through or went through or still going through periods where young graduates come out, as it was with the Arena Theatre Company and the Mechanicals Company, where people of the same age tend to get together and work together. And I'm not saying those are not great learning experiences, but the interface with more experienced things and the mixing of those ages' experiences is something that doesn't come around very often. Mm. I think it happens a lot in musicals. I don't think it happens a lot in, let's call them, straight plays. Just because they don't generate the same kind of money.
Yes, that is true.
You know, interfacing as Spring Awakening did with Lambda and a professional contribution, and now this one, I think it's a great vision. And, you know, Peter, Anton, and Dwayne are, I think, incredibly supportive for what we need to develop in the industry.
They're certainly doing very well, aren't they? Because, I mean, that show, Spring Awakening, got rave reviews from people saying it felt as though they were looking at fully professional actors and actresses.
Well, you know, I mean, I've been a teacher of acting for a long time, and when you're in the triple threat environment, it's quite intimidating. The talent is overwhelming, but it's exciting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's great. I'm very privileged to be there.
So when you were asked to direct this play, A Streetcar Named Desire, what, did it fill you with excitement? Did you think, oh dear, this is going to be a challenge, or
well,
or
it's a little bit more complex than asking to direct a particular play. One is put in a position to consider a particular play in relation to a number of factors, and the number of factors of, you know, taking a slot at the theatre on the Bay. The theatre on the Bay has to generate an income, to, you know, all of that kind of stuff. There's a staff to pay, etc. So it's about appealing to an audience that supports the Theatre Bay. It's about appealing to an audience that's interested in young talent in Lambda itself and young talent, and also at the same time to serve where students need to be, or graduating students need to be, focusing in their final year, and to serve the acting curriculum, if you like. So all of these factors are coming together. So I think the Tennessee Williams and A Streetcar Named Desire is a great classic, a great story. I think its themes resonate very strongly in our contemporary time, in our present time. So I think it's a great choice. So it's about what about this, what about that, and quite a time to consider what would satisfy all these different territories that are really important to consider.
And we take it all for granted, don't we, when we come to the theatre, all that's gone before. Chris, your first piece of music, A Kiss to Build a Dream On, Louis Armstrong.
Well, we're in New Orleans, and Louis Armstrong is such a strong signature. I love a number of his singing numbers. I think he's a musician of accomplished. I love the trumpet. There's so many elements of it that I love. And it's just such a gentle song. I just like the melody. I like the instruments. I like Louis Armstrong as a signature talented musician, singer, artist.
So all the reason to share it with us.
All the reasons, yes.
Right, here we go.
Give me a kiss to fill a dream on. My imagination will thrive upon a kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this. Kiss to fill a dream on. Yes. Give me a kiss before you leave me. My imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part. Kiss to fill a dream on. When I'm alone with my fancies, I'll be you, weaving romances, making believe they're true. They give me your lips for just a moment. My imagination will make that moment live. Give me what you alone can give. Kiss the bill, the dream on. Fences, yes, I'll be with you. Oh, weaving romances, yet that I'm making believe they're true. Babe, lend me your chops for just a moment, and my imagination we'll make that moment live. Yes. Give me what you alone can give. I kiss the villa dreamer.
The inimitable Louis Armstrong, I think we can say that. And that is A Kiss to Build a Dream On, the first choice of my guest on People of Note here on Fine Music Radio this week, Christopher Weir, who is directing A Streetcar Named Desire for the Theatre on the Bay, a production of Lamta. It opens on the 14th of August. And you said, Chris, it resonates today, because working with young actors, as you are with Lamta, it's very much an adult story, isn't it?
I think, yes, I think you're right to say it's an adult story, but I mean, you and I are sitting here, and I have to smile and say, when does adulthood start now? It seems to start at 12 or 13.
Well, that's the thought, yes. So, gosh.
But yeah, yes, there are sophisticated adult themes to it, but I think they can still speak to a younger generation than that. You know, I'm certainly 16, 17, these are really hard issues and territories to get through in mm-hmm. terms of that particular age. Perhaps that brings me to the point about what I think the play is essentially about and why I'm saying it should resonate mm-hmm. to a younger age, as well as what we might call adults post 18, 20 or something like that. And I think the play is essentially about the power of sexuality, the power of sexuality to either redeem or destroy, you know, and how we get through love relationships, because those love relationships are centered on the main characters, whether it's Stella and Stanley, whether it's Stella and Blanche as sisters, whether it's Blanche and her lost lover, and Blanche and Mitch. You know, they're very strong themes of that. Mm-hmm. So that, for me, is what the play is essentially about. Of course, the resonating themes that go underneath with that. Yeah.
And it's a fairly large cast, isn't it, really?
Well, there are four or five main characters. You know, they're the four central characters: Stanley, married to Stella; Blanche, who meets Mitch. I won't tell you what happens there. And then there's a let's call them a minor characters, but nevertheless important to the story, which kind of contrast to the other relationships, and those are two characters called Steve and Eunice. So there's six kind of central characters, mm-hmm. but there are other friends in it, friends, the card players, and other passers-by. I think so the kernel of the cast is quite small, really, but there are a lot of comings and goings and vendors and other characters in it, which, as far as I know, in a lot of stage productions, I've seen one or two stage productions, they tend to cut those characters out. Whereas if you go to the film, of course, you can go out onto the street and you see the real feel of the streets of New Orleans, and it makes a lovely contrast or juxtaposition to what's actually happening in the French Quarter behind those shutters and behind those closed doors. So what I've tried to do here is meet what an acting curriculum is doing in a training institution, looking at the number of graduates that are going out and trying to bring them into the production as an experience, but that's not the only reason. I also think it's quite important to keep the sense of what that community is. So I'm not really – I think I've brought in one or two extras, but all the others are – they're probably two or three, if I am honest, and say those are the extras. But the others are actually in the text, but which are usually cut out. So I've tried to keep the community and the outside territory alive in the show.
Part of the whole experience.
Yes, part of the whole experience. Yeah. I think there's some lovely surprises in terms of how we've tried to realize that. And again, I won't tell you what those surprises are, because it'd be nice to meet it for the first time without knowing.
Mm-hmm. When you do cast a play like this from a training institution like LAMTA, you presumably do auditions as
absolutely.
Normal.
Absolutely.
And you can tell immediately if someone's going to do it or not. And if they don't get it, they don't feel like jumping out the window.
You know, obviously one is not going to propose something when if you consider that you can't do it. You
That's
have
true.
To consider, do we have the talent? Because you want – this is important, that people – you're placing them in a position, in a public eye, to succeed, not to fail, you know. Mm. You can do other little projects where it's great to fail because you learn a lot, you know.
That's what you mean, yes.
So it's very important. So you're considering your material and your choice of production in relation to whether you can do it or not. Then comes the thing of you obviously have actors in mind, but I've always believed that in an audition, keep an open mind because you can be surprised.
Mm.
And I've had the luck, I might put it, to have had that experience of saying, oh no, it's got to be so and so, and then somebody else comes in and wow, what a lovely surprise. You know, and it because finally your allegiance is to the story. It's not about who you like and who you don't like. It's your allegiance to the story and who's going to serve that story plot. So in the LAMTA context, you obviously have a sense of how you can do it, but every student has to audition. Obviously, you know, first year is not going to get a role.
Mm-hmm.
It's not ready for a Blanche or a Stella.
Exactly, those big roles.
But
yes.
The experience of having to prepare a little piece and come into an audition is what is mm-hmm. really important. So it's a thorough process.
Tell me about this guest artist, Emily Child.
Emily Child. Well, Emily Child, I first met I think she was the first year at UCT when I was teaching there, and she was a lighting operator. But, you know, obviously had contact with her as a student, but essentially really worked with her and met her real talent is when we were founding members of the Mechanicals Collective. And Emily did some sublime work in there and has done even more work of great stature after the Mechanicals Collective disbanded, let's put it that way, after 2014, 2015. But she, you know, she's played Hermia in thing, one of the daughters in Lear, great roles. And so it's just, and then she's done a lot of work with playwright Louis Folloun. But I haven't worked with her for a time. And when we was looking at Blanche, realizing that, you know, that what the emotional journey is and what the emotional arc that has to be achieved in that particular story, it doesn't matter how talented you are, you need a little bit of experience and life experience. So, you know, it's important to go. Because it's not about age. I mean, Blanche is not 45. She's not 50. You know? Yeah, but you have to look for that experience towards that age. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to give away Emily's age. I don't even think I know it, but I could guess it. But the point is the talent and the experience. And what's more important in this particular context is who is this actress, Emily Child? She is the most generous actress. And that was important, you know.
When you say generous, you mean to the rest of the cast?
To the rest of the cast.
Yes.
Well, even to you, well, including myself as a director. I mean, she listens, she contributes, she's creative, she has incredible humility, just wonderful to work with. Yeah.
So she's been
A wonderful example of how an actor should work and should work. I mean, yeah. So
which is good
I can
for the
carry on praising.
That's lots of praise, Chris. So the youngsters working with her, as you said, will be able to learn a lot anyway just
they
by
have,
watching and listening.
They have connected to her in such a positive way. Yeah. And
if she's, as you say, generous and not a prima donna, then that's
absolutely
a huge help.
Yeah.
Your next piece of music, another favorite, Chris, Roberta Flack's famous song, Killing Her Softly.
It's a number I think I first heard in the 70s. I mean, it's not a new number. And I think one goes to songs in connection with an emotion, if you like,
very
often.
Much so. Very much
and
so.
I just found it as a song that was just soothing. If I remember a time in the 70s, it was quite a turbulent time, and I just used to listen to that song and many other songs, but that one particularly. And that was like chill time. Just listen to Roberta and you'll be fine.
And that lovely voice that she had to sing.
Yes, it's just warm and embracing.
Let's be embraced.
Let's be embraced.
Strumming my bed with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song. Telling my whole life with his words, killing me softly with his song.
Mm-hmm.
faculty found my letters and read each one out loud. I prayed that he would finish, but he just kept right on strumming my fate with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song, telling my whole life with his words, killing me softly with his song. He sang as if he knew me in all my dark despair, and then he looked right through.
Embraced we were here in the studio. I think that's Killing Her Softly with the lovely Roberta Flack and that lovely voice of hers. Another choice of my guest on this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. And his name is Chris Weir, Professor Chris Weir, and he's directing A Streetcar Named Desire for Lambda at the Theatre on the Bay from the 14th of August. It's come across, Chris, a lot of your passion for young people, giving people opportunities. But you were at one stage an actor, weren't you, before you went the teaching role?
Yes, I did. I went to drama school with the I went to university, let me put it that way, of which I did drama, with the idea of still playing tennis and possibly dreaming about being a tennis player.
Really? So that's a big thing in your life?
Yes, that was. I played a lot of tennis, but that was a kind of secret passion of mine. But I was very immersed in the drama world already. My maternal grandmother was an actress. My father was a director, an actor. So, I was brought up immersed with theater in rehearsals and shows and things happening all around me, so it wasn't foreign. And then, my schooling embraced the theatre, as it did sport and cultural activities like that. And we had great mentors in terms of teachers as well. So, it's quite an overwhelming question, and I kind of stopped because it was given to me. you know, and not a lot of careers are given to you or put in your pathway. It was kind of put in my pathway, which I'm eternally grateful for.
Of course. And it's I like the way you say it, put in your pathway. It was given to you.
Yeah.
You never had to sort of wonder what you were going to do.
Exactly, yes.
But then what made you turn to directing and setting up theatres like you did the Arena Theatre, giving young members an opportunity to play on lesser-known stages?
I have to... You know, my father was a great influence on me. I loved the way he gave people opportunities in terms of his practice in the theatre.
Would we know his name?
Tony Weir. A lot of people who were brought up in Rhodesia would know that name. Mm-hmm. And then I had a great mentor as a teacher, Neil Jardine, and many people will know that name. I became a headmaster not only in the Rhodesian schools but in the South African schools, as in Michael House, Kingswood. But in my days, he was a history teacher, and he was the captain of the Rhodesian rugby team, and he played the piano, and he acted.
Wow.
You know, so... And he was so passionate about giving opportunities to young people. So I pay a lot of tribute to him and to my father in terms of that. Mm-hmm. So it's always been interested to me to pass on skills, to share those. Yeah. But I love the young vibe. You know, that's what feeds me, you know, because you learn so much from them as well. As older we get more cynical. And
But I suppose when you say you learn so much for them, I think younger people tend to be slightly more robust in a sense that they would challenge you more than an established actor, possibly. Why are you doing this? Why do I have to do this? You know, just giving you more of a challenge.
That's true to a certain extent. I mean, you know, a lot of them do and a lot of them don't. Mm-hmm. And that's where the challenge lies, because of those two things coming at you, as it were, makes it more interesting, because it's about taking that robustness, that forwardness, that challenge, that questioning, and working with it and shaping with it. I mean, I think the essence, the bottom line is for me, I've always... in my kind of ethics of teaching, is training in this field is about the individual talent. It's not about molding somebody or planting a method onto people, you know, and imposing your way of working on them. Certainly you have ways of working, and they might come from lots of, let's call them gurus that you borrowed, but finally you're using it to nurture and to bring out the individual talent, and that's what intrigues me.
And it must be a skill, as you said, intrigues you too, because you've got to find something. You've got to find something in this person that you can say you've got this and you can bring it out. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
I do. Perhaps I can articulate that straight away. Is a lot of training curriculums will let's take an example of a first year coming in. They impose a particular curriculum on them, and that curriculum is about, here's what you don't know, and here's what we have got to tell you, to teach you,
right,
and for you to learn.
Right.
Listen, shut up and listen, you know, because we know everything. And for me, it was always a challenge that there was not a gap which in a curriculum that said, okay, here's the time where you are just listening. You are just listening. And I call it listening and reading the person, because I want to know who they are. And this has nothing to do with interrogating or putting your nose in their private affairs, but it's just what's the breath in this talent? Where's that coming from? How does it breathe? What is it about?
And then you
work with that. Mm. And that's what... I think I love about what we do.
Gosh, and you say it with such passion, Chris. And the directing part, did that just come along as you were training and teaching?
I suppose it did just come along. I mean,
Sorry, that sounds frivolous. I
mean, No, not at all. It wasn't as if I said, okay, now I'm giving up acting, I'm going to direct, because I started directing while I was acting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, the teaching career at UCT was phenomenal in many ways, because we were given the opportunity to direct outside and bring our professional experience into the experience of the undergraduates and the postgraduates and that. So one was working from a very privileged background, because you're working on a, let's say, a wage,
yes,
a regular
yes, of
wage,
yes,
you know, and you're not just freelancing.
Yeah.
So it gave one the opportunity to try out these things and take up offers to direct, and also then to create directing opportunities. But it was also about time as well. I think that has to go hand in hand with it, because once I started a family, you know, directing for 3 weeks or 4 weeks was much better than having to rehearse for 3 weeks and then playing for 6-7 weeks.
Yes,
as a very long time
around,
being
yes.
out of the house.
Yes.
So
it was practical.
In many senses, that mm-hmm. had to go hand in hand with the move from less acting to more directing.
Well, we're going to have another piece of music now, and I see the Beatles lurking in the wings. And I Love Her, one of their great hits.
Well, the Beatles, I mean, I was brought up in the Beatles, in the era of the Beatles, 60s. Everyone, so many people picked up a guitar. I picked up a guitar. We created a band. We played Beatles numbers. But my dad was from Liverpool, so they were like, I know them.
Yes, I'm going
to say. They're from my dad's neighborhood, even.
Did he have a Liverpudlian accent?
He lost it for he dropped it in favor of what he needed to be as an actor.
As, of course,
you know,
course,
everybody couldn't use your own dialect in those days.
No,
everybody had to sound the same, or let's call it, we had to be BBC English.
Oh yes, received English.
That way, received English. Yeah.
So we're going to listen to "And I Love Her."
Beautiful.
I give her all my love, that's all I do. And if you saw my love, you'd love her too. I love her. She gives me everything and tenderly. The kiss my lover brings, she brings to me, and I love her. A love like ours could never die, as long as I have you near me. Bright are the stars that shine, dark is the sky. I know this love of mine will never die, and I love her. Stars that shine, dark is the sky. I know this love of mine will never die, and I love her.
Beatles, there you are, and one of their hits, And I Love Her. And my guest on People of Note this week is Chris Weir, who is directing A Streetcar Named Desire for Lamta, the theatre on the Bay, from the 14th of August. And one of the things I wanted to ask you, Chris, was Tennessee Williams. People get obsessed with Tennessee Williams, and I often wonder what it is about him. I know it's very intense. I've seen some of his plays here. I've not seen A Streetcar Named Desire, but there's an intensity about his writing, isn't there? There's a sort of realism.
Intensity, I think, is a key word, because, I mean, and I think we're attracted to it, that intensity, because it's an intensity that sits in a territory that I think we all want. Love, security, protection, and those are all things in his stories, and I think that's what draws us foremostly. But then, of course, there's a context, and I think his contexts are very exotic in a way. They very specific worlds. I don't know if you've ever visited New Orleans.
No, I haven't.
It's very hard to describe. You can attempt to describe it, but that French Quarter and the music and the streets, I mean, it's just a world that you have to experience in order to be able to give it proper articulation.
So have you been to a place like
New Orleans?
I've
been to New Orleans, yes, I've been. I stayed in the French Quarter.
You felt what it's like, where this place is at.
I went to listen to music in the Preservation Hall, which is an old shed in one of the streets and things, and mm-hmm. basically you sit on crates because it's a shed, you know, and you get a hot cup of coffee or something, or a glass of wine or whatever, and go and sit on a crate. And what happens is generally speaking, great musicians who have played gigs in other places come at about 11, 12 at night and then jam with other musicians until 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. So it's a vibe that is very hard. And this, that was in the 80s. So we're talking about 1947 in relation to A Streetcar Named Desire. So what the essential difference is, I'm not going to try and articulate that, but I would say that New Orleans hasn't changed that much. It has changed. Of course it is, with the devastation of Katrina and all the rest of it. But I think its soul is still there. Its heart is still there. So back to Williams, I think it's about that intensity. I think it's about the context in which that intensity lives or breathes. A Glass Menagerie, Rose Tattoo, all of those worlds and his shorter writings. And I think that's the essence of it.
Mm-hmm. And A Streetcar, I mean, am I right in saying that it's the lower class people, isn't it? They're not rich.
Absolutely. There's a contrast between Blanche's family and Stella's family, which she has abandoned, in the words of Blanche, from the southern plantations and things like that. It's lower class, we can call it working class.
Stanley is
an immigrant. He's from Poland, post-World War. Everybody's there trying to rebuild their lives, very excited about it, building their lives. There's a lot of passion to find the American dream or realize the American dream. Yeah, but it does take place in a let's call it a lower class environment.
And Chris, what about the accents? I presume, are they doing American accents?
Oh yes, that's a skill they have to. And that's really key, because so much of their work is in accent work.
Yes.
Yeah.
And coping.
Well, they have great tuition. They have great teachers. You know, some fall into it better than others. But I mean, most of them do have a good ear. They sing.
Yes.
I'm always amazed how quickly they do pick it up. But some dialects, it's harder for them to get rid of particular sounds, and it takes time to do it. But the work that goes into it is rigorous, and the demand to be perfect in an accent is right there all the time.
Yes. So, and they are studying at Lambton, and as you say, they need to get to know this from the beginning.
Oh, accent is one of the key to skill areas that they are tutored in.
Chris, how have you set it? I believe Neil Griffin has
Neil is a meticulous artist and a very creative artist, and the detail that he sees is phenomenal, and he's very, very particular, as I said. It's a beautiful setting. I mean, if you don't like the play, come and see the set. It's beautiful. Right. It's an environment that evokes so much of the territory that we need to inhabit.
I said to you earlier that I sometimes when I think of a streetcar named in Desire, I find myself thinking in black and white because of that iconic film. But yeah. Here's a chance to see it in vibrant color, I presume.
Well, color in the sense, I mean, it's located in a particular setting, as you were in a particular period, mm-hmm. You know, and there's a color treatment to it. But also we're in the theater, so there's an interpretation. There's an artistic lens, which a set designer and a costume designer, because he's done both, that Neil sees it in. And that artistic lens marries itself to what the essence of our production is trying to say, and colors come into that. Are they muted colors? Are they bright colors? Where are the bright colors, if there are? So that specificity is informed very specifically by an artistic lens in relation to meaning.
Yes, I like the word lens, that sort of description. Just occurred to me, Lamta, I know they're producing actors and singers, the triple threat people. Do they also train technicians?
It's interesting you ask that. They certainly get an experience of what all those people do behind the scenes, as it were, what a stage manager does. So many of them fall into a wardrobe assistance, stage management's assistant management, stage management. So they all have to do an experience in terms of the backstage territory just to enhance respect for what happens, to support their performances. It's been interesting because the 6 years that I've been there, one or two of them have said, I want to be on the stage management side, on the technical side.
Right.
You know,
I
love the performance,
the
but I like this more. So that's very interesting.
Yeah. Good for Anton and Dwayne, but as they say here, they are so thankful to Peter Turin for setting this up for them because they're on the roof of, well, inside on the top floor of the Theatre on the Bay.
Well, I mean, what better place to have studios? I mean, the view and the environment absolutely gorgeous, yeah. And we're very, very lucky to have those facilities.
So, Chris, I'm going to leave it there and tell you that I'm really looking forward to seeing this now, Streetcar Named Desire. It opens on the 14th of August at the Theatre on the Bay, so go along and see it. And your last song is by Lady Gaga. Shall I be terrified of that and jump out the window?
I think she's an incredible performer. And why I chose that song is because, as I spoke about the other one with a particular context, Lady Gaga for me is about energy. And if you want something, go for it. Believe in yourself.
And it's called Shallow, this particular song.
Yes.
One of her well-known ones, better-known
ones? Well, it's in collaboration. It comes out of a movie and is sung generally with Bradley Cooper. So it's a song I think she wrote, if I hope I'm right.
Okay,
I think she's the sole owner of it. It's just about energy.
I want to creep a quick question in.
Sure.
Is music important to you?
Absolutely.
Okay. Because, I mean, I'm thinking of you as a theatre drama person. I mean,
I picked up a guitar. I played in a band.
So
I
did.
Played the bass, and I love the electric guitar. Has been one of my favorite instruments. I love music. I use music as a teaching tool. I use music to inform me. Not that I might not use the track in the particular scene if I'm doing it, but I might use it as a pulse indicator, a rhythm stimulus or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yes, music is incredibly important.
Or an energy one like this that we're about to play out with.
Go for it, Lady Gaga.
Lady Gaga, Shallow. Thank you, Christopher Weir. Thank you very much for
Thank
being
you, Rodney.
Here.
Thank you, JP, for this lovely interview. Thank you.
Are you happy in this modern world? Or do you need more? Is there something else you're searching for? I'll fall in all the good times I find myself longing for change, and in the bad times I fear myself.
Tell me something, boy. Aren't you tired trying to fill that void? Or do you need more? Ain't it hard keeping it so hardcore? I'm falling. In all the good times I find myself longing for change, and in the bad times I fear myself. I'm off the deep end, watch as I dive in. I'll never meet the ground. Crash through the surface when they can't hurt us. We're far from the shallow now. In the shallow. Shallow, shallow, low. In the shallow, shallow, low.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
This is FMR.